There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that.
This is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby. That's right. This man knows what's up.
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan.
My brother from another mother.
On FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, away we go. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Glad to have you here on this Tuesday edition of the show. Phone number, same as always, for a call or a text to 251-343-0106. 251-343-0106. Also, with the FM Talk 106.5 app, you can always leave us a talkback message at the front page, a landing page, whatever you call that thing on the app. You'll see a microphone icon. If you'll press that, lets you record a message, emails it, and we can play it back here on the air. So glad to have you along on this Tuesday. Lots to do on today's show. Coming up in hour number two, my man Jay Young from King Operating out in Dallas, Texas, is going to join us. The latest on gas prices. I mean, watch the fluctuations we've had here in the last week or so. Where are we going next? We'll talk to Jay about that coming up at 1 o'clock. Also, Rob Holbert from Lanyap, lanyapmobile.com. Talk to him about this, well, a couple things, but number one on the list, the story that hit, I guess, was it Monday? Yeah, maybe it was yesterday. The story that Lanyap's covered for 4 or 5 years about the Ethics Council Committee for Alabama, the Ethics Commission. The head of the Ethics Commission, Tom Albritton, had some questionable ethics choices he made here with spending from the Mabel Amos Fund for money that went to, well, his children. But Rob's got all the details. We'll talk about that at 12:30, plus the latest on Big Creek Lake and what happened here between Maws. I'm trying to figure this out, kind of reading through it, and we'll try to do that together on today's show. So as we start off, though, this story, and I couldn't help to think as I'm hearing the press conference from Sheriff Birch yesterday, I'm thinking about what happened to the Chalk family, right? That the story from South Mobile County, and that's still in my mind when I hear this from Sheriff Birch yesterday about a family in Wilmer, a triple homicide happening. And here's the press conference, a little bit of it from Sheriff Birch. Let's set that up. Let's go to cut one.
Sheriff, what can you tell us about what happened here?
Well, we received a call from a family member of the victims that there was some deceased individuals inside the house. Once we made entry, discovered, you know, the mother, 46 years old, had been murdered. All three victims had their hands bound behind them with zip ties or flex cuffs. The mother was stabbed. The 17-year-old was shot, and the 12-year-old's throat was cut.
So the 12-year-old's
throat was cut, as was the mom.
And she was stabbed in addition to
her. Yes.
Any indication who was killed first?
No, there's no way to know that, not at this point. They were in three separate rooms. And
is there anything stolen from the home? Y'all think this might be like a robbery situation?
We're not speculating anything. I can tell you the house was gone through and left in disarray. And so someone was searching for something.
You say like there's just like a bunch of tough store, like torn off walls throughout the house,
like dresser drawers, you know, left open, things removed from the dresser drawers. You know, just what would typically happen if somebody's searching for something.
These are her two children?
Yes.
Okay, the father, where is the father?
The father of the
boy is his.
And what I want to say, too, there was also an 18-month-old that was left unharmed at the residence as well. So.
And And so do all three children have three different fathers, or how many fathers?
The father of the 17-year-old is estranged, and but lives out of town, from what we're told. At this point, we don't suspect any kind of domestic or family type situation.
The family members of the 17-year-old said that she was also pregnant. Can you confirm that?
She was. She was 7 or 8 months pregnant. Yes.
And
the father of that child, a lot, as well as the 18-month-old, works offshore, and he's actually the one that triggered all this when he saw her phone activated in the middle of the night. It's good to have that Life 360. And so we thought maybe something was wrong with the pregnancy, and he, when he couldn't get her, reached out to another family member to go check on her.
The child that was unharmed, that is also a child of 17?
Yes.
And you guys don't know what this is about at this point? You can't say anything?
It's too early in the investigation to know. But we're covering all angles. And all possible, we're covering every possibility that we can.
Do you have any idea how long they had been dead?
It's happened sometime in the middle of the night. So, okay. It's the how long, it took, and we don't know if there was, one person, two people, we would presume that more than one person to be able to isolate three people.
So there are signs of forced entry,
that
broken door, broken windows?
No.
Have there been any past calls out there for any reason?
I don't want to touch on that just yet.
What about the father of the 12-year-old?
As far as what?
I mean, to see the questions.
Well, again, it lives out of state, so.
I thought that was the father of the 17-year-old. Is that the same father?
Yes. My understanding, yes. Again, we're still learning all the dynamics of the families and those living there. And it's been a little confusing from different family members.
With the death of the unborn child, would this be considered four murders?
It should be. That will be up to the district attorney's office. There's typically some, hurdles they have to cross to make that decision, but, that will ultimately be their decision.
Was there any signs that the victims fought back?
Not that we could obviously see. So. Other than being restrained.
It just sounds incredibly brutal case right off the bat. Do you have any comment about just the nature in which this, so far what y'all learned, how this occurred, brutality of the fact they were bound, possibly before they were murdered, that sort of thing?
Well, it wouldn't make any sense to bound them after somebody's murdered, but it would, for someone to... it tells me that they had a plan coming in to bring zip ties or flex cuffs in with them. So they had a plan when they came in, but to, if you got a beef with an adult, it still is not, there's nothing worth killing someone over, but to murder two children brutally, and a 12-year-old was almost decapitated. And so it was a brutal scene. And, I hope and feel comfortable we'll have this animal or animals off the streets soon.
So at this point, you believe more than one person was involved, but you don't know that?
We don't know that. It would be hard for one individual to control.
And those are cuts from a press conference yesterday, Sheriff Birch speaking. And I'll say this, we'll go to the news here in a second, but I hear from you on the text line at 251-343-0106. My reaction, first of all, is shock. Then starting to think about this. This is what happens in the show Narcos. This is what happens in movies. We have another situation now. I mean, think about this too. The Chalk family, three were murdered, a mother and two children in that. Same thing in Wilmer, mother and two children. You could argue with her being 7 months pregnant, an additional child killed there as well. These are things that seem to be at another level than what we've seen in Mobile County before. This is a trend or the connect. I don't know that it is, but your shock on this. I mean, obviously, our heart goes out to the family. It's it's, I mean, seriously think about the level of this, where they're going into homes, in the case of Chong family, taking them, in this case, killing them in their homes, rifling through, in the case of the Wilmer family, rifling through the drawers, looking for, what could they be looking for? I don't care if you say, well, look at the text line, I'm sure it'll be drugs and money. Sure. But drugs and money to kill a mother and to kill children like this? I mean, this is the stuff of drama TV shows. And it's happening right here at home. So we'll hear from you at 251-343-0106. Coming right back. More Midday Mobile here on FM Talk 106.5.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
So welcome back, FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along. 251-343-0106 to get in touch. I'm going to check in with my friend Anna at Mobile Bay Coins and Fine Jewelry. And let's talk about what's happening in gold and silver right now, Anna.
Well, they both took a little dip. But, I mean, it's not, still not a bad time to buy or sell. You know, they're still above $4,700 for gold, and silver still around, I think, $75.
Yeah, that's the point that I keep making. When people say, well, you know, day to day, gold is down X percentage. I said, okay, so pull that view back to 1 month, 2 months, or 365 days. It's been a heck of a return.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, my personal opinion, it might start dipping again. So, if, you know, and I've had several people come in with some scrap gold because they've heard our commercials and stuff. So they've been really happy. They were shocked of how much stuff they were sitting on, had no idea it was worth that much. It was just sitting around in drawers, you know, they got it all together, brought it in and walked out with some extra money for gas, finances, paying bills, whatever, tax season.
No, you got that right. And you pointed that out. So people, they think, well, I don't have any gold bars or coins to sell. How much scrap jewelry? I mean, people come in, you've talked about that. They come in with they only have one side of an earring or, you know, something that's broken, you know, a ring or something like that. And they come in and they walk out with considerable cash for that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, most of the time it's probably, it could be from a couple hundred bucks to into thousands of dollars, you know, depending of what it is. And some people don't even know that they have gold. They just think it's costume jewelry. If it's a family member that passed away, you know, or something got passed down in the family, they didn't know.
Are y'all buying silver as well?
Oh, yeah, we're buying silver, gold, platinum. You know, so we're happy. We're paying top dollar for scrap gold and silver right now.
I like it. Well, tell folks how to find you.
We're at 2204 Government Street in Midtown Mobile. They can find us on Facebook, on our website, mobilebaycoins.com, or they can call the store. Phone number is 251-725-1590.
All right. Thank you, Anna. We'll talk soon.
Thanks.
All right. There goes Anna checking in from Mobile Bay Coins and Fine Jewelry. Let's go to the text line here at 251-343-0106 and start here. And Michael, we'll get. I see your text here. We may have time later on the show to get to those, but stay on this presser we just heard. And unnamed texter says horrible. I agree. Jason says Sean, home is changing fast. Let's see, home is changing. Well, I just moved on me. Here we go. And I got to figure this out. So it's jumping around on me. We'll get back to that one. Let's see. Killer B said, I too immediately thought of the family and Theodore, too many similarities to be a coincidence. I don't know that it's related in that, Bees. I don't know that it's, but I'm saying it's a level of violence that is not, and not naive. I'm going to sit here and go, I can't believe there would be drug-related violence in our city. Come on. Okay. But this is another level. These are two times in the last year, this kind of absolute, the worst violence is taking place right here in Mobile County. Jason says, Sean, home is changing fast on us. Unfortunately, sure, we want these vermin caught, but they'll never get appropriate justice. Squirrel Vereen, notice Andrea Ramey brought up the mother's drug history. Now, not to victim blame, but knowing trouble that it can bring, it was kind of in poor taste yesterday for John Young, so my buddy John filled in for me yesterday, for John Young to go on a drug legalization crusade yesterday. Nothing good comes from it. Really? Scrofering? Maybe I misunderstand your text here. So, if the drugs were legal, and this is a theory right now working that it's drug-related, but they were going through the house, as the sheriff said in the press conference, looking for something, okay? If they were legal, would the violence that you just saw there happen? No, it wouldn't. That doesn't mean it's for legalization, but I think you're completely 180 backwards, man. I didn't hear John Shaw, I was traveling yesterday, but if he was talking about legalization, then that would work against the violence you just talked about. I mean, so it's just not to get, but I mean, you're the one who brought this up. That it was, and I didn't hear it, but I can go back and listen to it in podcast, which, by the way, all our shows podcast. That if you're talking about legalization, why would you think that? You think that violence would have more chance happening? I mean, help me with your logic on the text line. Let me know. Let me understand that. Yeah, Michael says horrible. Says I'm not an expert on gangs, but it sounds like MS-13 with me killing with the knives. Horrible. It's a horrible level of violence. Like I said, once again, I'm not sitting here like the naivete of saying, "Whoa, I can't believe that there." Of course, I mean, we've been somewhat conditioned. Sadly, we've been, where people just say, "Oh, it's more drug violence." But this thing is this is the TV show Narcos. This is the stuff that you hear the cartels doing down along the border. And twice this has happened here in Mobile County. And, you know, thinking about it this morning, how many times you think somebody who could do something like this, you've been standing in line at the gas station, you know, at the convenience store with, or you sit next to them at a lunch counter, or whatever it is. This is another way. I mean, beyond the chronic gun violence of our city, the back and forth from gang elements that is a scourge on our city, this is another level of what's happening here. I know the law enforcement wants to get the people involved in this as quickly as possible, and I want to as well. I just wonder, to see two of these things happening in such a short period of time, it, to me, not a lot shocks me. This one shocks me. Joel says, it's not the same people as everybody used to think. Oh, Wilmer is just a little old country town. It's not that no more, Sean. The demographic of people is not the same as it was 10 or 15 years ago living in Wilmer. Wilmer is a drug-infested location. Now, everybody that used to live in Wilmer don't live in Wilmer no more. Well, even with it, I mean, you follow where I am, Joel, on this. Even with the drug infestation, if that's what's going on in Wilmer, this thing that transpired, this murder spree that transpired, is truly beyond the pale. And it's, like I said, not much shocks me. I wake up, and how many times I've come on to do this show, and people say, "I'm shocked by this or that." I'm like, "Eh, I think that stinks, but I'm not really shocked by it." This is truly shocking. All right, and we'll get some more text from this later on in the show, coming up here in just a little bit. A story that I think Rob Hulbert and I have been talking about for, well, probably 4 or 5 years. That's the Alabama Ethics Committee, right? So there's a whole other story about the Alabama Ethics or Commission. You know, how you're supposed to report. This even involves what happened to Admiral Kent Davis. But atop Alabama's Ethics Commission, the executive director is Tom Albritt. And the reports that were coming in over the years from reporting from Lanyap showed that Tom Albritt was overseeing the Mabel Amos Memorial Fund, which actually I'll get Rob to talk about it. Mabel Amos Memorial Fund is kind of an interesting thing. A woman who worked in state government, who obviously saved her dollars and also had some land that produced some money from natural gas, I think, or oil revenue, held on to that money, put it up as a way to put Alabama children who needed it into college, and the person running it used some of that money to put his kids through college. Talk to Rob about that when we come back.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
FM Talk 106.5 Midday Mobile on this Tuesday. Glad to have you all along. 251-343-0106. 251-343-0106 gets you through. And remember, you can always leave us a talkback message using the FM Talk 106.5 app. We'll get back to some of those texts from earlier, but let's add some more to it as I get in a conversation with my buddy Rob Holbert from Lanyap, lanyapmobile.com. Hey, Rob.
Hey, what's up, Sean?
Well, what's up is it looks like how many years have y'all been reporting on what's going on with the Alabama five. Ethics Commission and Tom Allbritton, and how many years have you and I been talking about it?
It's been five, yes.
5 years.
5 years.
5 years of this discussion. And this, I mean, early on, the irony of this was made it easy talker. You're like, wait a second, we've got questions of ethics involving the Ethics Commission executive director. That got my attention early on. And then it's obviously come full circle, and I want to get to that with his resignation. But first, I told the folks we'd set this up again. You and I have talked about it many times, but this is questions about the board overseeing the Mabel Amos Memorial Fund. Can you take a second and tell them about that fund? I thought that was kind of an interesting story, how that fund came about.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. So Mabel Amos was a former Secretary of State of Alabama and was a secretary for, I think, five different governors or something like that, including Wallace. When she was in her 90s, she went to the Allbritton Law Firm in Andalusia and had her will drawn up and created a charitable trust in her will that would give scholarships to underprivileged kids when she died. And she died at age 99 in 1999. The trust was formed. They start handing out scholarships. There are small, not a lot of them. And then in 2010, oil was discovered on land that she had owned, and millions of dollars started pouring into this fund from royalties. And so I think currently it has about $8 million in it.
I mean, it's an amazing story. So you have a secretary working in state government for five different governors, I mean, all those years, and then she goes to have her will done, and she decides where she's going to put the money is to help kids go to school. Okay. So, and that's a great thing as it is. I mean, because that was her heart, and that is fantastic. And then after her passing, they find oil, and this thing becomes, maybe through, providence, divine providence, it ends up being this. It's pretty amazing. That part is really a smile. It's a good story.
Yeah, it is. Except that they started giving out money to, Tom Allbritton's daughter. Tom Allbritton was one of the board members. There were three members of the on the board: Tom Allbritton, who is, and then one of his partners at the law firm, Rick Clifton, and then a lawyer from Regions Bank. And Regions Bank is they handled all the business for the trust. And so, in 2012, they started handing out money to Allbritton's daughter, $15,000 a year, and scholarships. And then by 2014, they stopped putting the names of people who are receiving the scholarships. And so they went from handing out, maybe $20,000, $30,000 a year to handing out $300,000 in scholarships a year. And so we know that Allbritton's children got $135,000 worth of scholarships. We know that an appellate court judge, Ben Bowen, he's one of the state appellate judges. He received, his kids got at least $35,000. I've heard it's more. There's allegations that a bunch of kids of the people who worked in the law firm and people connected with the law firm got scholarships, as well as there's a bunch of money that has gone to University of Alabama and Auburn University to their athletics departments that nobody really knows what that's about. But it's pretty big money. So over the course of the last 10 years, they've handed out over $4 million in scholarships and there's no list of names of who got it.
Okay, this brings up so many questions. First of all, what Mabel Amos wanted this money to go to. Now, you've listed big donations to athletic programs. You've talked about people. We're going to get into the ethics of self-dealing here. But the definition of who she wanted this to go to was not – it was people who needed it, right? Kids who needed it.
Correct. Yes, it was to underprivileged kids. It was to kids who –
It was underprivileged kids to go to college.
Good grades,
that was the idea.
Needed help financially. Yes.
Okay, so that's the definition. That's the spirit of what Mabel Amos set up.
Correct.
Then the section – now we go into – the what you just delineated, that list of people. I don't have the tax returns on these people, but I'm going to guess if you have positions in banking, your attorney, all that, you're not unable to pay for the child's education.
Right. One would think that Tom Albritton, as a lawyer and the head of the Ethics Commission, is not somebody who would consider his children underprivileged. And I think that that's the case with several of the people. I mean, the only two that I absolutely know about are Tom Albritton and Ben Bowen. The others that are alleged also come from clients of the law firm, people who are, worked at the law firm. So those are allegations made by the people who sued. So that I guess I should say that, we broke the story and about 5 years ago, within a year, a lawsuit was filed by some of Mabel Amos's surviving relatives. And then it turned into, it's such a long and winding story, but it turned into kind of a mess. Another lawsuit was filed that got folded in. The attorney general was originally a defendant and became one of the plaintiffs in the case. And then he tried to have all the other plaintiffs kicked off the case. And has tried numerous times to settle this thing secretly, kind of quietly with Regions, and has been rejected by the Supreme Court. I mean, it's been a wild ride, man. The whole thing has been crazy. I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, you're talking a lot here on the civil side. People are going to ask, too. You're talking about civil cases, but 5 years of this, nothing from a criminal or a state oversight? I mean, it's pretty obvious.
Yeah, well, here's the issue. You had the Attorney General, Steve Marshall, who in a brief in this civil lawsuit accused Tom Albritton of self-dealing and fraud, two criminal activities. And when I asked him years ago, why didn't you charge him with a criminal charge. They said, the statute of limitations ran out. But they sat around for years and let it run out.
We talked about it. We thought that maybe there was, at the point that Marshall brought that we said, Attorney General's going to do something here, right? This is going to be, there's going to be some movement on this.
Right.
And then for it to wither on the vine, I wonder if that was just a placeholder to say, hey, I've done something about it, but knowing that, they bring a bill up at the end of session to say they brought the bill up, but they're going to run out of days and it's never going to get, in front of a committee.
Well, when all that was going on, Albritton and Marshall were fighting with one another. And there was that's a whole other thing, but there was some issues regarding what the Ethics Commission and the Attorney General's office, they were at odds over things. And, I think what it looks like to me is it was sort of an effort to exert pressure to say, hey, you look like you've been involved in self-dealing and fraud. And so they kind of cleared up their mess. And then all of a sudden, Marshall went from being, kind of an antagonist to Albritton to, in my opinion, and what I've seen over the years, is to try to help him get out of this case, to get out of being sued or having to do anything. The other plaintiffs have asked for him to be removed for years. They've been trying to get Albritton removed. I mean, this thing sat there for well over a year with not even a single ruling on any kind of motion or anything with the first judge. That was appointed to it. And it's just been dragging through. I mean, it's a 4-year long lawsuit still.
Yeah, it's interesting. So, I mean, possibly, if I'm hearing you right, you think maybe that the fact that the Attorney General moved on it, that I remember you and I talked about it a couple of times. We said, okay, something's going to happen here. Rob, you've been talking about this a while, and you think that might have just been leverage for something else?
It looks like it to me because he didn't do anything. And everything he's been doing for the last 3 years has been basically to try to get the people who want all Britain off the board, to have them thrown off out of the case, to block any kind of efforts to remove them or to have the list published or made public. The judge, they came to the judge and said, hey, we have an agreement with Regions and with the defendants, with all Britain and some of the other board members, to make the fund whole, whatever that means. And the judge said, well, basically, I don't have any of the information, so I can't agree to this settlement because I don't know what was spent and what was wrongly spent and that kind of thing. I mean, there's pretty much at this point an admission, a tacit admission at least, that there was some misspending that went on. And it looks like Regions basically has picked up all Britain's legal fees. It's just all, it's a mess, man.
And it's interesting. Once again, so is the defense here, what was there? I mean, over the past, did he not realize that giving money to his child, I mean, would be, number one, wrong as being the commission, Ethics Commission executive director, that on its own, or that it didn't fit with the description of who the money should go? I mean, did he say, well, I didn't know that? I mean, what was his defense in doing this just specifically for All Britain?
So when I first contacted All Britain 5 years ago, this is the only time he spoke to me until last week, or responded to an email, I'll say, is he said originally that he was he got a ruling, an opinion, that it was okay for him to do, and that he had recused himself. So his former law partner and the other guy on the board voted for his kids to get it, that it was okay for his kids to apply.
I had forgotten that it would be okay. I'd forgotten that part. So it's like, a few of us that are friends, like it's you and
morally.
I, somebody else that are on a board, and there's money going to go to my child. I'm going to recuse myself, but y'all are going to vote yes.
Yeah. Okay. You know, Sean, the reality is that the this kind of thing probably would never, ever have even been noticed. I mean, I'm sure that when they were doing all these things, they had no thought that it would ever get any public scrutiny. And the only reason it did is because, you know, some of this kind of woke stuff where people are going back and looking at people who are, you know, scholarships are named after and things like that, who were involved in the civil rights, you know, are doing things that during the civil rights era that they didn't like. Everybody's at Alabama, some of the students were looking at this Mabel Amos scholarship, which is funded by the Mabel Amos Memorial Fund, and said, hey, you know, she worked with Wallace. We shouldn't have a scholarship named after her. And when the professor started looking at everything, he called me up. He said, you know, that's one thing, but, you know, does this seem weird to you that this ethics, the head of the Ethics Commission gave his kids money? And I was like, that does seem weird. And, you know, that seems like a story. Yeah.
You know, also strikes me, and y'all see all this at landnetmobile.com, is a follow-up or a adjacent story to this. It said, when asked by reporters on Friday, three of the five ethics commissioners, George Pappas, George Pierce, and David Chips Pruitt, said they had no idea that All Britain had been involved in litigation alleging he and the original Amos Fund board members, Rick Clifton and John Bell, were awarded scholarship funds to family members and friends instead of underprivileged students. They said they didn't know, they're on the dang board with him.
Yeah, well, it gets even worse because the chair of the board is a guy named David Dodd, who is an attorney from Muscle Shoals. His brother, Alan Dodd, represented Steve Marshall in the lawsuit for 2 years. So there's no possibility he's not aware of it. I mean, it's a three-person firm.
They're trying to say, well, we had no idea, so we can't be, we're not culpable here. We're not liable.
Yeah. I mean, look, Alan Dodd was representing Steve Marshall in this case for a couple of years. Then Nathaniel Ledbetter appointed his brother. Out of all these people in the state, out of all the lawyers in the state, they take a lawyer from a three-person law firm and appoint him to the Ethics Commission, which immediately created a conflict of interest. And then Alan Dodd continued to serve on the to serve Marshall on that case until we reported it, and then he resigned.
After 5 years,
you know, the whole thing, the concept that the commissioners don't know, certainly that the chair of the board is, that it happened. I find it hard to believe that nobody has mentioned it to them or that they haven't seen any of the coverage. I mean, I know we've covered it a lot, but at least some
and
of the others.
Not just for 5 days, for 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, some of the media outlets in the state have done a little bit on it. Yeah, it's not. This is not new. And you would think if you were going to be joining the Ethics Commission, you might Google it and just see, like, what's going on?
Wow.
But, you know, Ivy left those positions vacant for 3 years, over 3 years, which is a violation of the law. By law, she's supposed to have appointed, and she wouldn't do it. I mean, we asked that question years and years ago. Why are these vacant? And just keep getting a stone wall why they hadn't appointed. Now, all of a sudden, right before she's getting ready to leave, she has filled the board finally.
Hmm.
I don't know if that's indication of something to come or not, or if they were aware of some of these things going on that Albritton was about to leave the board. But it is, you know, the efforts by Marshall have been to just kind of tuck this thing away, but they failed. And with that last effort with the Supreme Court that was kicked back, he is really, I think they're just kind of out of moves at this point.
Yeah, this text said, unnamed texter said, didn't the Ethics Commission save Marshall's career on a 3-2 vote? Sounds like the
yes,
AG was just being a blowhard.
And that's one of the things, the Ethics Commission didn't nail him for $700,000 pack-to-pack transfer, you know, when he first was running. So, yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of people in Montgomery who like this wounded, sort of ineffective ethics commission that doesn't do anything. I mean, it serves the purposes of people who aren't very ethical, for sure.
It's I'm trying to find the acronym, ACKINO, or so, Ethics Commission in Name Only, maybe, or it's
yeah.
And you wonder going forward here for the Ethics Commission with all this coming to, you know, well, you put the light on it for 5 years, but with the resignation, to think back, something my mother always told me is to be on, you know, be beyond reproach. In other words, even if you're not doing anything wrong, don't look like you're doing anything wrong. If you're in this position and you're over the Ethics Commission, wouldn't you, I mean, more than any other citizen, wouldn't you kind of be, you know, pretty tightly wound on what you could and couldn't do? I mean, wouldn't you be like, yeah, that probably could get, that probably is okay, but I'm not going to do it because I don't know, I'm over the Ethics Commission.
Well, you know, to be perfectly fair to Albritton, when his kids started getting money for scholarships, he was not the Ethics Commissioner yet. That happened the year before he became Ethics Commissioner. However, he is an attorney. He is familiar with the concept of self-dealing. It specifically says it in the will that creates the fund, that there can be no self-dealing. It absolutely says that, very plain English. And so, you know, he should have, just even from that standpoint, even before he was supposed to be in charge of the state's ethics, said, this is not a great idea for me as an attorney to do this. But then, obviously, once he became the ethics, the director of the Ethics Commission, they kept going on for years.
Wow. This has truly been the work that Lanyette's been doing for all these years. You could even obviously go look at the latest stories, but go back in time through the internet machine there at lanyettemobile.com and get all the stories leading up.
Those things are all out from behind the paywall. They're all out there for even people who are sadly not Lanyette subscribers at this point, but they can go read them if they want to.
Okay, and remind folks, too, if they want to subscribe, how do they do that?
You can go to lanyapmobile.com and get signed up for a subscription. It's only $1 for the first month, and it's 30 cents a day after that.
Good stuff, man, and it funds this kind of work, Rob. I appreciate it. And, hey, this came to fruition. 5 years of us talking about the same story, and now it's changed. That's good.
It ain't over yet. There's still a lot to come, I think, but we'll see.
Okay. That's a tease. I like it. Rob, we'll talk soon. Thank you, man.
All right, Sean. Y'all have a great day.
Bye. Will do. There he goes, Rob Hulbert with Lanyap, coming right back. More Midday Mobile.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along on this Tuesday. And, yeah, some of these texts here. Joel says, Sean, this is what you call BS, and nobody's going to go to jail. Nobody's going to get in trouble. Watch what I will tell you. Although Rob says there's some more coming on here, Joel. Yeah, we'll keep an eye on it. But it's been 5 years. And then for members of the commission to say, well, we hadn't heard it. Three of the five say, we hadn't heard about that. Come on. Just say, you know, yeah, we knew, whatever. Joel goes on to say, I wonder how much of the money with that new addition at Auburn, some of that money is being used. Just asking as a concerned citizen of the state of Alabama, laugh out loud. David says, Lanyap needs to keep digging into the airport authority. There's more dirt there. Just sweetheart severance packages for the last two executive directors. Yeah, that one's interesting as well. All right, Jay Young from King Operating joins us next.
There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan.
My brother from another mother.
On FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, away we go. FM Talk 106.5 at Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along on this Tuesday. Phone number and the text line, they're the same. 251-343-0106. Plus, with the FM Talk 106.5 app, you can always leave us one of those talkback messages right there on the front page of the app. You'll see a microphone icon. If you press that, lets you record a message, and it emails it to the show. And we can play it back here on the air. All right, let's talk about oil prices out there, and let's talk about the future on that. He's with King Operating out in Texas. He's my buddy Jay Young joining us now on Midday Mobile. What's up, Jay?
How you doing, Sean?
I'm good. How are you? How are things? Well, let me ask you this. Let's see, can you find, is there drilling pipe laying around out in the Midland Odessa area, or has it all been put to work?
Man, I'll tell you what, right now everybody's going to work trying to sell as much oil as they can this month. You know, with these increased prices, our partners are they're screaming in the streets. I mean, I don't say that too bad, because I know that majority of your listeners are paying more at the pump, and that's not a good thing. They don't want to pay more at the pump, but they are. But I'll tell you what, for the oil and gas industry, Texas, and for creating jobs. And the increase in oil prices have really helped our investors, you know, make some money.
Yeah, I want to talk about that, too, as it goes with the Permian Basin. Or, I think a couple of weeks ago, last time we talked, I was like, hey, JD, I saw this the other day that West Texas Intermediate was trading higher than Brent. And it's gone back to the normal ratio. But I wondered about that because there were, you know, news stories. I mean, this is your everyday business. But news stories about tankers coming here stateside to take it back and put it in the global marketplace and the number of ships doing that. I was like, well, maybe that'll drive, I mean, WTI higher than Brent.
Yeah, exactly. And there was so much disruption at that particular time. And Brent's crude, that gives you a premium because of the transportation that they have to place on it, the transportation and the time involved to deliver, you know, a bunch of tanker trucks full of oil in the future. So it kind of gives you a premium. But yeah, you're right. I remember that. Man, you're like, why is this and what's happening and is this going to happen in the future? And I said, no. I said it'll come back down. But every once in a while, when there's this big disruption overseas in the Middle East, or if there's something going on, you'll see this little, you know, the spread isn't as good as it was before. But in regards to us and paying higher prices, we're going to be paying higher prices for a long period of time. I feel like, as I mentioned last time on the show, it's like we have only so much oil in the markets. And we've been cutting back our drilling in the United States.
She's got your stuff.
For several years now. And we're going to see an after effect of that really soon. Because when you're drilling, you're not drilling as many wells as you were in the future or in the past. I'm sorry. If you're not, it's oil and gas goes up and down because of supply and demand, right? I mean, it's like,
right. Why
does the stock market go up? There's more buyers and sellers. And the same thing on the other side of that is, why does prices go up, down? And it's all about supply and demand, and that's exactly the reason why I've been talking about, you know, these higher prices going into the summertime and at the end of this year, because we don't have the oil and gas markets like we did back, you know, 2 years ago when we were drilling like crazy and we had a lot of oil in the market and we could shift around, and OPEC wouldn't throw so much oil in the markets, and you know, and prices went down at the end of last year. You know, prices of oil were $55.
Please.
In December, we saw below $2. Alabama, you know, Texas, Oklahoma, we saw less than $2 for gasoline. Now it's coming up because of the war, but it's also coming up is because we have a lot more. We have some oil that's not there like it was before. You know, if you don't drill for oil and gas, it's going to go down. It's going to evaporate. We're not going to have that oil, so we've got to get it. And that's what's happening today, Sean, is we have a lot of oil in the world that we're not going to have access to in the future. I know that's something you wanted to talk about. Is where are we going to get this 100 million barrels a day for the world consumption in the future? If Middle East wells that are shut in right now, they're not going to come back on like they were before.
Yeah, I do want to visit that, but we'll go backwards for a second here. You're just joining us, talking to Jay Young with King Operating. Jay, when they hit oil and gas infrastructure in the Gulf states and Iran and all that, getting those facilities back online is not like, hey, it's like, you know, me with a set of channel locks and go out there and 3 days later I got the thing back up, right? So that production will be offline for, could be years, is that, or months? What's accurate?
Well, I mean, they'll come back, and so a couple of months, 2-3 months, you'll know exactly where these wells are, because some of the wells may never come back. If you have a well producing over there, you're producing 5,000 barrels a day. If you shut it in and it's turned back on, it may only come on at 2,000 or 3,000 barrels a day. Very normal, very, very normal with oil and gas wells, especially oil wells that have high pressure. They have high pressure. It's like a Coke bottle, champagne bottle. It's like you know, you may never see the pressure come back like it was before because it's shut in. And that's exactly what's going to happen. And you'll know in 2-3 months whether or not these wells will come back on at the same rate. We've done it before here in Texas. We don't like it. We don't like it, but that's just what happens. And sometimes we have to shut in our wells. Like I said, we don't like to, but we sometimes have to. And when we do shut them in and bring them back on, like they're having to do in the Middle East right now, I mean, every every storage capacity over there is completely full of oil. It's like there's nowhere else to store it, so they have to shut their wells in. And when they shut these wells in and they turn them back on, they just don't come back on at 100%. And that's what's going to hurt oil supply in the future.
Jay, world oil supply too. In the I'd future. I'd love to have the crystal ball here.
We need a lot of oil in the United States every year.
About who
world.
Knows and when, you know.
And we're not going to have it.
Oil trading, right? So the war is on and the oil prices are up, and then we're close to a deal. The oil prices comes down and this and that. I mean, there's some money being made on those margins right there. Just if I only had the information others have, I might be able to retire by the end of the week.
Well, there's going to be a lot of people come out of this thing saying that they made billions and billions of, like during the financial crisis. There's going to be some of these people come out and go, we predicted oil and gas prices throughout this whole thing to go up, down, sideways, whatever. And there's going to be, but there's going to be probably about 400% of those or a lot, a bigger percentage are going to say it broke us. I mean, we thought we're going to go long and we thought oil prices are going to go up. They didn't. Because there's some days you're like, why isn't oil $120 a barrel? It should be right now. It should be $120 a barrel because of what's going on over there,
yeah.
Shutting down wells, not mm-hmm. getting oil out of the Strait of Hormuz. I mean, there's just so many different reasons why prices should be. It's not like we've never been at $91 a barrel. $91 a barrel is, we've been there quite a few times. Without a war.
Yeah.
You know, so
I mean, that's a good point, too, that number should be, okay, barring the other movement here by government, you think oil should be $120 a barrel right now?
Oh, at least. Have the necessary here in the United States, or because it's coming down, but also around the world, when you're shutting in all these wells in the Middle East, the Persian Gulf that needs to get oil out of there, and you can't because there's just you can't get it through the strait. You can't sell it. You got to hold it. Well, they shut it in. That's 10 to 15 million barrels a day. Like with Trump, I saw something yesterday. It said that 60% of the people are blaming him or more for higher gasoline prices, which it's only obvious that if he didn't create this war, prices would not be so high. That's an obvious, you know, but he needed to do it, and he needs to finish the job right now for sure. But
you know,
he's seeing what the after effects are when you drill for oil and gas wells and you don't have the production necessary. You're seeing a holdback or supply coming down. And when you see supply coming down, you're going to see prices also go up. And that's what's going to happen in the United States, especially at the summertime and into this year, regardless of a war.
No, and I do want to get to what those prices and your projection on that. Before we do, though, something else you talked about, there's production side, there's also refining side. I think specifically we got in the conversation because last time you were on, people said, well, why is diesel so much higher, you know, as a percentage than gasoline? And you said we weren't refining diesel here in the U.S., right? Not much.
Right. Yeah, we're not. And to see that from a standpoint of how much, you know, oil that we produce in the United States that is a, you know, a commodity or it's a, you know, majority of the, but you see the majority of the oil that we produce here is a lighter crude. It's a higher grade crude. And we can't put that in our refineries and make gasoline out of it. And that's one of our problems, is we can't do that. So of what we have now is we're having to export a lot of that crude, export it, and then we get it back, but we're not getting it back like we need to.
Is this enough motivation, though, Jay? Is this enough motivation here with this going on that it's then it becomes financially, you know, the right choice to expand our refining capacity in the United States? New facilities, grow the facilities that are there. Is this a wake-up call?
It should be. And for us to be financially independent, and we're still not independent, because we still don't produce enough oil in the United States to produce this. So we don't produce 20 million barrels a day in the United States. We don't produce 20 million barrels a day. So if we did, we'd be safe, but we're not. And so since we're not, we're having to go to other countries. Like, now I will say this, we are not dependent on the Middle East. You know, we are not dependent. We are dependent on Canada and Mexico. So we're not like we need, you know, the oil that we did before. We don't need that. Now, if they do flood us with some of that OPEC oil, then that does cause problems, you know, with oil prices. Or it's better if OPEC does, you know, take care of it and put some oil on the markets here in the United States. That is better for gasoline prices. But to be, and this is something that Trump said the other night, he said, we don't need Middle East oil. And he's almost right. I mean, it's not like we need a lot. We need 20 million barrels a day in the United States, and we need less than 500,000 barrels from the Middle East. So it's good.
But that delta between, and I, and like every time you're on, I have you say it. Because when the president said that the other night, I was like, yeah, dude, because we consume how many barrels a day in the United States?
20 million barrels a day, yeah.
And 13, you said, or whatever comes from here inside CONUS, right?
Right. 13 million in the United States, which we can't refine all that. So, okay, we can only refine like 10 to 11 million barrels a day. We have to send the other off because we can't refine it. But and you're right, if it's a wake-up call, maybe we can or maybe we will in the future. But right now, we're not.
I wonder if this might be more an advanced question, but do you think if the OPEC nations saw more refining capacity coming online in the United States, new facilities, expansion of facilities, they would start, even when the plans were announced to do that, if they would start flooding oil in, ramping up their production to bring the price down to make it seem like it's, to try to keep us from doing that?
Yes, I would. And I think they would probably put a lot of oil on our markets to bring the price down so much that it wouldn't make sense. Because that's kind of what they do. That's kind of what OPEC does. When they want to, and they want to market share, and they don't want prices to be so high, because the higher prices are, if prices are $100 or $150 a barrel, we'll see a lot of oil and gas companies in the United States drill more wells. So that makes sense? You know, if it's $150 a barrel, and we don't need OPEC. OPEC wants us to want them.
Yeah, I agree. And it's almost like we'd have to go, okay, we know what OPEC's going to do when we start talking about expanding refining capacities. We just got to keep our heads down. They're going to flood the market, but we got to keep on going. You know, it's like just pretend like this is not happening because we know in the future it's going to be the right choice.
Exactly. We need $70 to $80 oil. We don't need $120, $140 because then OPEC does some crazy things. They'll flood our markets full of oil like no tomorrow. We don't want that. So $70, $80 oil, just like Landman said, just like Billy Bob Thornton on Landman said, hey, $75 a barrel's great. It's not too high, not too low. Consumers can handle it. And it creates a lot of jobs. And there's oil and gas in Alabama, Louisiana, mm-hmm. Mississippi. I mean, there's good oil out here in the South, and we'll just continue drilling, and we'll be dependent. We won't even need OPEC.
Yeah, we just have to, you know, have to not chase that shiny object when it comes up with the lower prices. All right, and before we close out, too, you've done this each time, so you're talking about you feel these prices, no matter the ins and out of the war with Iran, we're not seeing any break from these high prices this summer, right?
Exactly. Yeah, we're if it comes down, if we do come down, we'll come down to the 70s, maybe the 80s or something. I don't see much less than $75 a barrel. We've lost a lot of oil in the United States and the Middle East right now, and we're going to be looking for oil for a long period of time. So it's going to be where we need to find the oil. We don't know where it is. And, I mean, they're talking about, you know, increasing the value or increasing the production in Venezuela. or South America or other countries, that it's going to be a deal where we're looking for oil. So it's like the United States or it's like the world is looking for new places. It's like looking for brand new places for oil. Sean, it was like whatever the United States is producing and whatever OPEC does, that's kind of how the price goes up and down.
Hey, Jay, I've got to hold you over. Hey, Jay, we're up against the break. I got to take a quick break and come right back because we have run out of time. This segment coming right back. More with Jay Young from King Operating right here on Midday Mobile.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Welcome back. Just a minute left here with my buddy Jay Young from King Operating out in Dallas, and always just a great source of information when it comes to oil and natural gas. More education, people can get that from you. You got a book. Heck, you wrote a book on it.
I did. I sure did. I wanted people to think about if they want to invest in oil and gas. For many, many years, we would do a lot of risky projects where it's like it was a 1 out of 10 chance to hit. If we did, it was an incredible prospect, but chances are really good, 9 out of 10 times that you wouldn't hit. So we did that for years, and then I thought, man, there's ways where clients can make good monthly income. And we're showing double-digit returns right now. The double-digit incomes, they can get incredible tax benefits, which the government allows you great tax benefits and a multiple. And I'm like, man, if this is something that I can put together for clients. So I wrote a book about it because I wanted people to know that there are different ways to do it. And there may be a way where you're like, hey, I'll throw $100,000 at a exploration type deal. I don't really care about $100,000. Well, that's not the majority of our clients. Our clients like to invest in projects that they feel comfortable that they're going to make some money back and you know, make some tax benefits, which you have tax benefits with each one, but the best deal is that. So you go on my website, kingoperating.com, and I'll send you one of my books or my book called The Upside of Oil and Gas Investing. Would love to.
Good stuff, Jay. I appreciate it. Always appreciate it when you come on, and we'll get you back on real soon.
Sounds great. So take care, and God bless the people of Alabama and our troops over taking care of our country.
100%. There he is, Jay Young from King Operating. We're coming right back after the news on Midday Mobile.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along and good time to check in with my buddy David McCrary at LCM Motor Cars. What's shaking, David?
Hey, bud. Good day. We've got a lot of inventory coming. We ended up buying 8 yesterday. This morning, bought a little Ranger boat, something you'd like, but it's already sold. Somebody's looking for one, and we found it online and got to go pick it up this evening. So we've been busy.
Okay, let's talk about you've got those. What about in the world of like mid-size SUVs? I mean, those are so very popular. How are you looking?
I got 30 of them.
You're doing pretty good.
We've got a load of small SUVs. We do really well with them, and I try to keep them in inventory. CRVs, RAV4s, little Buick Encores, all those little cars do real well.
Okay, well, let's talk about people coming out and checking out those vehicles in person and that great website.
The website, lcmmotorcars.com, in person. We're at Highway 90 and Plantation in Theodore. It's 1 mile south of I-10, exit 15A. At the third red light on the left, or just give us a call, 251-375-0068.
Good stuff, David. We'll talk soon.
Have a good day, bud.
Hey, you too. David checking in from LCM Motor Cars. And we'll check in on some of your text at 251-343-0106. I kind of got to thinking about this during the news break. So talking to Jay and, you know, the question about refining, right? So we always think about production, but Jay's told us over the years that we end up sending crude out to have it refined to be brought back in stateside. We don't have the refining capacity. But if we do have new projects for expansion or new facilities for refining, what does OPEC do? Well, they flood the market, right? They raise production, flood the market, bring the price down, and make it not worth the effort. What if we did it remember the Russians had the Potemkin village, right? You put things up to look like, let's just flood the zone with applications for refining capacity. Not really do it, just have like projects in the works, shovel ready, whatever. Let that drift over to OPEC, then they flood the market, bring the price down, and we don't, you know, and then don't end up having to build the refinery. Of course, long term, I think we probably should. But I think that, you know, just fake them out. Do old, you know, the old Potemkin village end around. This from Irish Indians and Sean. I purchased at one point a lot of H2 hydrocarbon resin from ExxonMobil. They now have gotten out of that business. How's their production in oil and gas? I mean, ExxonMobil still on track for, I think, 4 million barrels a day. Yeah, and I don't know how much, there's a bunch of it coming out of the Permian, where that's what Jay and I talk about. That's that Midland, Odessa, that's the Landman Basin, right? The Permian Basin in West Texas. And then they, I know they're doing Guyana producing there as well. So, I mean, they're still a player. And they're still, I would say, I don't know the specific part where you're getting their byproduct, but I know they're still producing a lot of oil out there. So here, hold on, let me Google this. Let me shoot. They're expanding. Yeah, of course they are. Exxon planning to expand production in the Permian Basin up to 2.5 million barrels a day by 2030. So that, and then the rest, I guess, coming out of their operations in Guyana. So there you go. It's just, we're at a point here where listen, I want to go back to something Michael and I were talking about on the text line, too. And I said something to Jay about it. But if you watch this play here on just the short term, the day in, the intra and intraday trades on oil, it's been interesting. You have the war is on. All right, prices have, and it is also, let me go back and set the stage, like Jay said, without these other levers being used, we'd be looking at $120 a barrel oil right now, which we're not at. But you see these moves where, what are we at, 90.89, so $91 a barrel. But you see the move, it opened at $85 today. It's been as high as 91.45. In the few days, that delta in between those two numbers, people have been making trades. Now, what information they have that we don't have, right? That you get, hey, are you going to announce that we're signing a deal, right? We got the crew signing that there they are in Pakistan. They're going to sign the deal. Okay, that's going to obviously bring the price down. Oh no, the deal didn't work. We're back. The war's back on. The price is up. That there's a lot of money being made right there. And it'd be nice to know what the announcement would be before it came out. If you could work that out, let me know. If you know what the announcements would be, please let me know. But yeah, Michael, I've been watching some of those same stories. He said there's already been billions made on shorting oil before Trump's announcements. The BBC's been running stories on the weird coincidence happening within 20 minutes prior to his announcements. Yeah, I've seen those same stories, too. They show the movement in trades out there. Now, you could say, well, that information is public, but it really isn't. Because are they going to come out and say, you watch the way the markets move, even outside the oil markets, watch the stock market, way it moves, like, hey, we had something as simple as, I think we've agreed on a couple tenants to this peace agreement with Iran. And then the market goes up, and then it doesn't look good. The Iranians don't want to do that. It goes back down and up and down. Like that in between, it's like it's almost day trading, commodities there. But it's nice to be able to do that when you have the information of what's about to be announced. Also, I got to get to the story, and hopefully we will talk about this more in depth later this week. And the reason I say more in depth, because I'm still trying to digest what has happened here. So this has come out, and the story's up all over the place. Looks at different TV news sites. Landyap has it here as well. Let's read Landyap's for a second. And this is to my Big Creek Lake folks. You know, I'd like to get your reaction as well. This coming out, the lake lawsuit is settled. That's the headline at Landyap. A lawsuit challenging state officials. Now, remember, we'll go back. Let's hop in the time machine with me. Here we go. And conversations have been on the show with, like, DCNR director or commissioner Chris Blankenship. We've asked him several times, and he's put this out, it's been public, that the state's opinion, in other words, not Chris's opinion, but they went through, what is the state, what does state law say about Big Creek and Big Creek Lake? They designated Big Creek as a navigable waterway. It's without bias. It's just, it's not like particular to this case. It's what does the state define that creek as? And they defined it as a navigable waterway, and then it was dammed. And going forward, like we've talked about, all the nuances is if you could get on the water in a public access, then as long as you didn't set foot, and I don't think any of us that are fair-minded have said there needs to be trespassing going on, but if you could get on the water in a publicly accessible place, you could use the entirety of the water, except for where the boom is there. Not the new boom that's supposedly in the Ellsworth damage, the one that's down there by the, you know, by the dam, that you could be on that water because it was publicly, the water was public. So you can get on it publicly, you can stay on it, okay? Well, here it goes. So that was the state's opinion. That's what's been out. In a Monday afternoon press release, the Mobile Area Water and Sewer System and the Alabama Department of Conservation and Natural Resources announced they had negotiated terms to end a legal challenge over the state's position that Big Creek Lake in Mobile County is a navigable waterway. Okay, so this was the, remember all the, they sued DC, law sued DCNR, a lot of individuals as well, or a few individuals. Here's this is why I said it's going to take some time to get this, because there's not any clarity here. There's no details here. So the joint motion to dismiss the lawsuit initially brought by Moss was filed earlier the same day. So earlier yesterday, they filed it to dismiss the lawsuit, and then they come out, they have a settlement. It says the settlement itself and its terms have not been publicly disclosed. Anybody holding their breath on us finding all that out? Representatives from both parties did not immediately respond to requests for documents. The settlement resolves. So here's the thing. The settlement resolves a legal controversy over public water access without a judge ruling on the law, which has been playing out in a Montgomery County Circuit Court. Moss has argued that the reservoir is part of its water system and could be closed to the public, while Blankenship and the Alabama Department of Conservation and Natural Resources have maintained that the lake is a public waterway. Okay, so that's the two sides, right? We've talked about that a lot. They've dismissed the lawsuit and come to an agreement. I have a feeling that's going to mean the not former, but it's going to be the latter. It says, further in the story, it says it's unclear how the settlement impacts how law enforcement will treat access to the water. So that tells me, as a tell there, they're saying that Moss has control of the surface water of Big Creek Lake, Prosecutors in Mobile County Sheriff's Office have both declined to charge or remove individuals who have navigated into the water in defiance of the utility's closure. The distinction's important to Moss, as it would solidify whether the publicly owned utility could close the water of the body, not just the land surrounding it. The water system first permanently closed the lake to the public back in February of 2025 in the name of protecting drinking water while preventing invasive species, though it has backed off of that hardline stance in subsequent discussions with lawmakers and local officials. In a joint announcement made yesterday, both parties said they reached this after months of good faith negotiations. So Moss Director Bud McCrory said, "I'm pleased that Moss and DCNR could work constructively together and reach this settlement. This preserves our ability to protect drinking water for 350,000 area residents and takes the steps needed to prevent invasive species and other threats to our water supply and water rates. In addition, we're also able to ensure thoughtful public recreational access to the reservoir, preserving outdoor opportunities for residents and creating new opportunities for people who have been previously unable to access the reservoir." So you've probably seen the news stories now. You know, the facility where you can go, you've got the dock there. You've got the boat rental there. So this is the agreement, right? That, okay, well, you've got access to it, not like you did before, but you can do the rental boats, It says Mons will open the recreational facility with boat rentals, bank and pier fishing, and picnic tables. So that's, you know, in this negotiation, they are going to do these things. But the key here is, if you want to go back, they haven't, they're not doing that because it's a public waterway. They're doing it as a, hey, we control this waterway, but in good faith, we're going to give you the boat rentals, bank, and pier fishing. So the way I see this, they could decide that that's not going to be going forward. I'm not saying they will, but I mean, right now it's through their graciousness that they're letting you have access to it, not because you have the legal right to it. Under the agreement, Moss agrees to regulate the public access for fishing and certain watercraft under watercraft use under management, safety controls and regulatory conditions that will be in place to protect water quality. Those plans have been in place by Moss for roughly a year. Commissioner Chris Blankenship said the deal balances public access with water protection. So here's what Commissioner said. Our department's role is to protect and enhance public access to Alabama's natural resources, and this agreement balances the need to protect water quality with public access. I'm very appreciative of Moss's efforts to work with us to produce a plan that achieves both of these goals in a responsible way. So your feelings on this, 251-343-0106. It's going to be interesting to me. So once again, they can say, hey, we're not stopping people from fishing. You can fish from the pier there and the bank and rent one of our boats. So they're telling you, see, that's the underpinning to this. They're telling you you can do it this way because the underpinning is they control the lake. So 251-343-0106. What do you think about that? We'll do that. We'll come back. More of Midday Mobile on the way next.
Is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along. And let's check in with my buddy Blaine at Parrish Tractor in Robertsdale. What's happening, man?
Hi, Sean. How are you?
I'm good. Let's talk. First of all, I guess it was Friday or something, I was talking to him. He said, hey, you and Blaine have not talked about your rental weekend special. I said, we did the other day, but hey, he didn't hear it. So let's do this. How do you work that deal, man, if going into this weekend?
Yeah, so you give us a call or come by the store here in Robertsdale and get that set up. Our rental specials are still going on right now. You pick it up on Friday or get it delivered to you on Friday. As long as you keep less than 10 hours on the machine, you will only be charge for one day of use, and we'll either come back and pick it up on Monday morning or you return it to us by Monday morning and just get charged for one day but have it for a total of about three.
You know, and you and I kind of focused on like skid steer rental and all that I use, but I mean, y'all are renting all kind of stuff. I was thinking for the backyard projects, and man, if I'd have had this, you know, the more than once that I resodded the backyard in a house I owned years ago, it'd been great. Y'all have gear that can get in the backyard, like through your fence, through your gate on the fence.
We do. So we got the mini stand-on skid steers with all the different attachments. We got normal-size skid steers and mini excavators as well, dump trailers, man lifts, telehandlers, you know, the bigger excavators and dozers, but all the way down to hand tools. If you need to rent a chainsaw or a pole saw, we've got those as well.
Okay. And then, of course, I was thinking about this. I just mowed on Saturday and Sunday, we got rain, man. And so already grass was growing, but finally got a little bit of rain. So let's talk zero turns.
Yeah, so we got plenty of zero turns in stock right now, still offering that strong financing through Kubota. So come by and check them out. We got all the gas and diesel models in stock right now. We can package these together for you with trailers, with our steel handheld products. And if it's something that you're not sure of, you've never owned a zero turn before, something else is we offer those in our rental fleet as well. So you can rent a zero turn for the weekend and try it out or for the week. So plenty of stock right now here in Robertsdale at Parrish Tractor. Come by and see us and we'll get you all fixed up.
Okay, that works. And I'll also remind them they can hop on the website like I do and check out the inventory there.
That's right. So you can go to ParishTracker.com, check out all of our new and our used inventory. So all of our trade-in equipment is a wide variety of stuff. It's not just tractors and lawnmowers. It's implements. It's side-by-side, skid steers, mini excavators, all the above. You can check out right there on our used tab of ParishTracker.com, as well as our rental fleet.
Good stuff, Blaine. We'll talk soon.
Thank you, Sean.
All right. There goes Blaine to Parish Tractor in Robertsdale. Grab a couple texts here before we wrap up and get Feinbaum on. Jim in Georgetown said, didn't a refinery in Mississippi go online about a month or so ago? I'm surprised Trump didn't fast-track the building of more refineries on his first day back in office. But see, that's and you're right, Jim, but that's what Jay and I were talking about, is that when we start expanding refining capacity, OPEC will flood the market and bring the price down to and refine it offshore for us as well, to make it seem cheaper. I mean, to make it not seem cheaper, make it cheaper, to where the motivation to pour in capital in to build the refinery is not there. Then we go another cycle or two, the prices go back up, but they know it's going to take years to build another refinery. Almost just have to, you know, bite the bullet and do it. Tim said, Sean, I thought it was against the law for you to block a waterway, and that boom definitely stopping you from navigating the waterway. Plus, they got in the chain link fence across 158 at the creek where you get in. Yeah, that's Juniper Creek. Yeah, they did. And right now, the way I see it, Tim, is like that. And once again, I'm going to need some more refined opinion on this thing. But reading through the stories from KRG and Lanyap and elsewhere, I'm looking at the people say, oh, well, you know, people can go fish with the rental boats or they can go to the pier. That doesn't mean you have it's a public waterway. The way I read this is Maas wins. And Maas says it's not a public waterway, but as part of our deal, we're going to let you access through our rules that water. And you can say that's good enough for you or not good enough for you. But it does, to me, it says, even though it doesn't come out in the document, and like the reporters asked for documents and it hasn't come out yet, to me that says the decision made, the agreement is that that is not a public waterway. Right? I mean, that, I don't know how I can think differently of it. If there's, because it's like, hey, we appreciate them giving us access to this water through these, through the pier, the bank, and these rental boats. But you couldn't, you wouldn't say that for the Tombigbee River, right? The state wouldn't go, thank you to a Sullivan's Landing or whatever for letting us have pier fishing, bank fishing, and rental boats. Because it would, because the state makes a decision, not the utility. So to me, it means the utility does, in this agreement, they are the controlling. That is not public water. Is that's what it's what I feel. We'll see. Joe says lawsuits need to continue, so there's a legal precedent, regardless of Maas offering to open. Time will come, and they will try to close it again. And once again, another interesting angle. If you go back and listen to the interview I had with Chris Pringle last week, he filed the bill at the end of session, but he's going to file it again this year. It'd be interesting to put the land around, if we're talking about protecting water, to put the land around the lake that Maas owns in a easement that would keep it from being developed in the future. Be interesting. All right, Paul Feinbaum is on the way, and he'll take over from here. We'll do it again tomorrow. Y'all have a great one.